Strangely enough, computer does not want to switch off the sound. He wants to talk. Today we have our session on studies of language. So computer also wants to join us and to say his word. You see? Well, today we will be two of us, I guess. Yes. I will present the whole overview of what is linguistics and what main issues are important for these studies and why they are important for us, for integral studies in general. I would like to make an overview in such a direction which will open us up to integral studies of ourselves, not just to stay with the observation of history of linguistics. By the way, I will paste all the files on the website, and they are available for those who want to have an overview on the history of linguistics. And there is a very good brief of all directions and all the developments starting from the times of Greeks and Pliny. But today I would like to concentrate on main issues, and I made printouts which I will distribute later for us to look into and to try to understand it. So where should we start? From the beginning?
Yes.
From the heart.
From the heart, from the beginning, from the overhead. So at the beginning was the word, yes. And the word was with God, and the word was God. And interestingly, that nobody follows after this phrase, but if you read further, you will find what happened to that word. That word started to travel. It came down and became a flesh of man. Flesh. The word becomes flesh, very unusual concept. So if we look into fundamentals of what is this word and where it comes from, Sri Aurobindo starts his observations from the vibrations of spoken word. He says, let us suppose a conscious use of vibrations of sound which will produce corresponding forms or changes of form. Let us realize, then, that a vibration of sound on the material plane presupposes a corresponding vibration on the vital, without which it could not have come into play. It's quite obvious that anything which appears on the material plane has its own prototype or beginning somewhere in the vital plane. That again presupposes a corresponding originative vibration on the mental. It could not come into the vital without having somewhere vibration on the mental. The mental presupposes a corresponding originative vibration on the supramental, at the very root of things. So everything which may appear here as casual, even passing speech, even irrelevant, presupposes its own originative vibration somewhere higher after the supramental plane. But a mental vibration implies thought and perception, and a supramental vibration implies a supreme vision and discernment. All vibrations of sound on the higher plane is then instinct with and expressive of this discernment of a truth in things. And that is important, discernment of truth in things. I will come to it again with Derrida's concept of trace, where he came to the same view that there is something which is distinguishing within itself, and it is always there present. This discernment of truth of things, in things, sorry, and is at the same time creative. It's not only discerning, it's not only perceptive, it's also creative. Instinct with the supreme power, which casts into forms the truth discerned, and eventually, descending from plane to plane, reproduces it in the physical form, or object created in matter by etheric sound. Thus, we see that the theory of creation by the word, which is the absolute expression of the truth, and the theory of material creation by sound vibration in the ether correspond and are two logical poles of the same idea. They both belong to the same ancient Vedic system. And here we have to, not to say to look back and start from the Vedic. The quotation is from the Upanishads, page 126. So basically Sri Aurobindo built up the whole view of the four planes, and here maybe papers would be useful. You can, I have only 10 copies, you may have one, or we can share them. I have this one. So I would like to draw it also, because by drawing it we concentrate on it again. Though it is there, you can see it. I'm not very good at drawing. It doesn't matter. What matters is to gather the speed. So basically, Sri Aurobindo defined four planes. So to say, supramental or beyond mental, other mental. Mental. Vital. And physical. So, if the word is traveling from the highest of the mental, supramental plane down, bringing its form. So we have these four levels which are corresponding with Indian tradition of Bhartihari, which support our theory. We have also Paravak, transcendental speech. We have Pashyantivak, mental speech. Seeing speech. We have Madhyamavak, mediating speech, language, and we have Vaikari, expressed material speech. In the studies of the signs of sutur and trace, those of you who are familiar with these terms. Sushil came to the discovery at the beginning of 20th century, to the same discovery which Bhartihari made long ago, of correspondence of signified and signifier. Whatever is signifier in our speech, whatever we say about the object is a signifier of some kind. But what is signified is the concept behind it. Signifier itself is not the sound, as he discovered, sound as it is in a raw presentation as a natural sound, but it is a sound which is articulated within, mental sound, also to say the projection, sensible sound of speech, as we call it. So these two signifying signified build one sign, and the reader, he describes it as a trace structure. And his comments are quite interesting on this, because he says that then signified is has to be presented in speech. He is never there. You cannot catch him by the signifier, because there is a discrepancy, as he says, in the moment of a breath. You are never catching the signified by speech, because signified is always there before and after speech is being formulated. So it's some plane about which we only point, to which we point by the signifier. So signified is never there, and signifier, which is signifying that signified, is never that. So it's never there, never that combination which makes the sign, about which we presuppose we know, by which we know things, but which we think and speak about things. So the reader goes farther and he defines it as a trait structure, which is which he developed into his own vision, very interesting, and he takes every term under eraser, he calls. Under eraser means that he never takes it for pure gold, so to say. Yeah? He always says that this is only a pointing finger. So when you speak about anything, or anything is written, it has to be crossed if you mean really the signified behind. Because if you presume that the word, the signifier, is signified, then you fall into a trap of what he calls the whole development of language in the Western civilization, starting from Plato, as logocentric. So that means we presume, or we think we know. Yeah? We think what we speak is true. But basically there is nothing of the kind. There's some other reality living parallel to it, to which we have very little relation with our words. That's what is, in general, a very simple word picture of this problem. So if we locate here the center, in the center this spine or trace, you would have an interesting picture. So from one side we have the formation, you can see you don't need so many of them, yeah? There are many more. On one side we have a signified, so to say, that which is to point off to reality, to the form, yeah? I right in terms of form or mind, meaning, mana or artha, meaning. It's quite interesting that in for those who study Sanskrit, that artha has two meanings. One is meaning, and other is object. Just look at this, the position. The meaning and object, the signified, something substantial, something real, being. Being and meaning are somewhat put into one term. Mm-hmm. On the other side, we have another structure, another representative of the signifier, I have to do these lines because it is the realm or the field which signifier covers. And this signifier is what in Indian tradition is called vak, vach, speech, nama, nama and rupa, name. Rupa and nama, the form and name. manas and vaj, with thought, thinking and speaking, artha and vaj, the sound and meaning. Now, the correspondence of sound and meaning is a basic issue of linguistics. We never went farther than that. It all rotates around this issue throughout, up to the most modern times. Nobody solved this issue. So I propose here a solution. Very simple solution, but it works. For me, at least, the skin represents something very interesting. Look at this beautiful skin. On the physical plane, on the plane of realities, we have two distinctly different realities. This is represented by the form, represented by the word. So we have, if you look at any reality around us, we see forms and we see the meaning of those forms. And we don't see them, we know them. If you look at this pen, we will not see a pen if we would not have linguistic reality or reality of the signifier telling us what it is. How would we know what it is if we would not have the perception of it already somewhere from the signifier side, of the side of the word? If word will not tell us that this is a pen, we would not know it. We would see something which we could not define without the word. It's not definable. We would not even define the color, we would not even define the shape and the use, and altogether the whole structure disappears. We would see something different from something else. We would see this as different from, even that I'm not sure how far we can do without the word. Can we really distinguish it between the forms? But suppose we can, but we would not know the meaning of it. It's like if you imagine the face which tries to communicate to you something, you see it directly, you see it with your mind, you see the form. You have a direct contact with the being, but it tries to communicate and you don't hear. You do not know what the face wants. So if you do not know what the face wants because you don't hear the word, and the word represents something which is not visible, which is not immediate in your contact with the form, which is hidden within the form, within the meaning of the form, because the meaning would be to write, and before I write with this pen you would not see it and would not know it, then it's clear how they correspond. So the form or the sight, the seeing, that's interesting, another important word, seeing and hearing, yeah? Two basic faculties of our consciousness, so seeing is of this direct nature, of the direct evidence of the truth, yeah? Drishti, revelation, when we come directly into the contact with the body, with something substantial, we have a touch of it, we already in touch with the truth as such, yeah? But who has seen the body of the king? Asked Sri Aurobindo Hisarich. Nobody has seen his body, the body of the Lord. We all are in this interesting vach, or hearing, indirect evidence of the truth. We hear about him, but who has seen his body? It's not yet there. It's on the way to be built. Eh? So seeing is, of course, superior to hearing. Superior in a sense that it is of direct nature. Yeah? Direct identification, or, as Shubhendu says, self-identification. But hearing is of indirect nature. Whatever is not visible, whatever is not here, whatever is intentional and has to appear, which is not yet brought from those secret places. That's why the whole concept of speech was of that secret. It was hidden within the being of the divine, and had to be manifest, had to be brought down. So much has this capacity to bring it down, to vibrate, to stir the consciousness, into creating the form. Now we can see how they correspond. If this is the sign and this is the center, so within this sign we have four different relations. We have relations of them as clearly distinct. They are not the same. The form of the pen and the form of the word pen within the semantic, within the linguistic structure is not the same. But they are the same on the level, they are crossing here, on the level of semantic, on the level of meaning. The word pen means to write, as pen also means to write. They are both one and the same on the level of meaning. That's the parallel part of it. So they are the same on the level of meaning, they are not the same on the level of form, they have their own different so-called realities, which the reader considers that they are completely different, they even don't cross anywhere, it's just a trace in the mind somewhere which makes them cross. But somehow, in the Vedic vision, on the higher plane, it is considered that this consciousness power, this is power, again, very important word, power, and here consciousness, this power consciousness is one, and it is here one. So semantics, where the sound or the word and meaning are one, is on the level of the consciousness power, beyond the mind. So yes, the power represents the sight, the form, the body, the embodiment, and the consciousness represents the knowledge, chit-shakti, or chit-tapas. But it is beyond. I cannot really extend it, I have to write it somewhere there, from where it originates. So these two, consciousness and power, they create all the puzzle of our manifestation. So it is pressing down and it is being realized as word and as a form. In this scheme, no one dominates. Word is not dominating over the power. And power is not dominating over the word. It's one consciousness which is in such a way built up that it's creating manifestation in this particular way. The linguistic reality and the reality of the objective reality, so to say. Now, it has a depth, this scheme. So I write it, I draw it in the hierarchical structure, higher and lower, but basically it's not true. It has to be deeper. So if we could see that this is the surface, and beyond that surface there is vital, and beyond that mental, and beyond that supramental, you will see different picture. It's difficult to put it into three-dimensional here, but it is not flat. As such, it cannot really express the concept. So, if on the physical level we have two distinct realities, if I write word pen and show you a pen, they will be two different realities. You can see them clearly as different, even see it, not only to hear it. But on the vital level, where the structure of pen to be corresponding meaningfully to the structure of other things around, because this form has a particular meaning relating to other forms. For example, it fits to the hand, the form of the hand makes it fitting with the form of the pen. It fits to write on the flat, it has ink. Ink is made in such a way it flows and leaves the trace on the paper. Paper is made in such a form that it would fit to the ink and the hand, and everything in this format, so to say, formation, all these bits of this puzzle are meaningful together with this pen. It doesn't stay separately meaningless to the reality which is surrounding it and where it is used. Now, in the same manner, the pan is used in the linguistic structure on the same or similar manner. It has its own particular formation as a word, which is used in a particular relation to other words, to write, to see, to put ink into, and so on and so forth. You will be surprised how to say, mirror each other, these two realities. So we constantly live in our linguistic reality, mirroring it outside and seeing it outside as such. And by that we create our outside reality. There's nothing in this world which wasn't created by this mirroring. Yes, this table, this computer, everything is a mirroring of our understanding of those relations in the linguistic space which is projected outside into the form. Now, these two formations, they correspond. They have correspondence, but they are different. They correspond fully only on the semantic level, where the meaning of the pan and the meaning of the word pan is to be utilized. So that was my solution for the problem of sign and trace, which I found many years back in the university and was very happy with it, and still happy with it, unfortunately.
Why do you put rupa, the form, on the side of meaning, on the side of the signified?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
The form is also a signifier. It vehicles something which is beyond itself.
If we reduce everything to one, to fundamental realities, if we reduce everything to only fundamental realities, we do not mix. Now what you are proposing the form of the sound. Now, it's an interesting, because the form of the sound is here also. If you look into, I do not know what, did I write it there? There is a sound image, and there is a form image. Now this image is a form, yes. There is a form of language. The whole grammatical structure is a form. It's a particular, because mind makes forms. Since mind is interfering into this formation of the sign, it creates formal structures. So the whole grammar is a formal structure. There's nothing else. Syntax is the mind creation within the linguistic space, rather than the word as a vibration meaning. This vibration meaning was structured in such a way that it could be applied in this manifestation of time and space. Now, I have to tell you one myth which will explain why form is on the side of the mind and vach or nama word is on the side of knowledge. Well, I thought it was obvious because this is the form and if you know how the form to be used, then you have to have a knowledge about it. And mind, it seems, we are so, let's say, determined by that mind knows, that mind is a knower, and knowledge comes through the mind, that we can't imagine even that it is not the mind itself who knows, but the mind is shaping out the creation. He is the power of formation. He makes form, division. He is the one who makes the trace possible. Rupa. He is the one who cuts everything into bits and uses the material, meaningful material of this creation, of the knowledge, in such a way that it becomes meaningful. The pen has meaningful relations with the paper and with the hand. Why? Because there is already the presupposed higher meaning of it. I will tell you one myth from why in Indian tradition Indra is considered to be the first grammarian, and Indra is the Lord of the Divine Mind. It's a difficult issue, I know. It's not so easily, understood. But once it is understood, once the glimpse is there, everything falls into very interesting investigation. Brahaspati, Brahmanaspati, was the Lord of the Divine Word, the first Sanskrit teacher, the teacher of Sanskrit who taught it to the gods. And Indra was his first student. So Indra was sitting at his feet and was learning from him Sanskrit. But since Brihaspati's speech had no end, no end means there was no clear demarcation, there was no cut within his speech, because he was always true to what he was sounding. There was no difference between the meaning and the sound. In that moment of time, he was true to the sound he was sounding. So how can you really learn it? How can you really apply it? Indra understood he will never learn Sanskrit. It has no end. So to sit there and speak forever makes no sense. And what he did, he stopped his speech, his flow, cut it into bits, grams, and applied them as a grammar. So what did he do? He utilized the substance of that knowledge, of consciousness, of vibration, of true vibration consciousness, he created grammatical categories of predicate, subject, object, time, number, and filled them with this word. Now this word can be applied in any context, in time and space. Before it wasn't possible. This myth is considered to be the creation myth, because the time and space were not there. Now there is a possibility of application of that particular meaning in any context. So the word would not lie, but the context in which it is applied may lie, may make you lie. If I say the truth in a wrong context, I lie. So misplacement of the truthful substance was made possible by Indra inventing grammar. That's why he's considered to be the first grammarian.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
Another explanation of the difference comes from the Aristotelian view of form is the essence. It's the permanent thing which is the result of that action limiting, which is permanent. Speech is a form of motion. And when something is in motion, according to Aristotle, it does not have form. And so this act of naming, once the name is known, becomes form. And there's a constant transition going on between the world of becoming, which is always in motion and never is in a final form, and the final form of everything, which is always present. And this is the distinction that Dravida makes in defining this act of speaking and knowing, which is always based upon the difference which we hear, the difference which we see between one thing and another thing, but we don't hear or see the form. We distinguish the differences between everything that we see, hear, touch, and that difference that we perceive becomes for us a perception of a thing, a form. When on the other level, on the level of perception, it is always only difference. And that difference, he calls it difference, is disappearing constantly. So the trace is there in that world of motion, form and
form is always what we derive from all the differences that we constantly perceive. And therefore, that semantic realm is known as the transcendental signified. It's not ever something that exists in the physical or the vital. It exists in the mental to some extent, to the extent that we're able to repeat it and visualize it and hold on to
one
it.
One needs a bit, yeah. All the rest is beyond. This is wonderful comment which clarifies certain issues on the trace and on the semantic, because I have another proposal for the semantic. Since semantic was never understood what it was, and even studying in the university, I asked all professors, could you please just clarify for me what it means, even meaning of the word, if you take it as a lexema, lexical meaning of it, or the chair, or anything. So what they did in the university is interesting, and it follows the tradition, the most recent tradition of Chomsky and everyone. Chomsky, for example, developed his own structure of language. He speaks in syntactic semantics. He speaks about this formulation of the mind. He is a scholar of the mind. And it's quite interesting. Derrida is the same. But they never, how to say, they only glimpsed beyond, and they never tried to really link that beyond to the word, but to the form, yes. To the formal aspect of the word, but not to the word itself. Now, if we would look into this issue more close, I asked my professor in the university to describe me any lexema. What is the lexical meaning of the word chair, for example, yeah? Or table? He said the table is, the lexical meaning would be that it is a flat surface with four legs, or preferably made out of wood, and so on and so forth, can have different shapes, round, square, and so on. On which you can. So I said, why do you describe me the form? You are describing me the object. Can you please tell me the meaning of the object? There is no meaning. It's only a form. And here the whole issue lies. Yeah? There is no meaning of the word table. There is a form which is implied as a meaning of the word table. It's a big issue, and it's not solved altogether. No way. There's nobody who can tell you what is the meaning of the word. And it is clear why. Yeah? Clear why? Because actually all this movement of discovery started with the opening, with discovery of Sanskrit. But it was too soon that they dropped Sanskrit and they started to investigate themselves. They made as Rajiv Malhotra, although I don't like him fully in his approach.
U-turn.
Yes, they made a U-turn too soon. Because if they would look deeper into the Sanskrit, what Sanskrit proposes, it proposes exactly the solution for meaning. And the solution for meaning was lying in the etymological system. Etymon, system of simple root sounds, which have their own field of meaning and can be applied into any context and create any other meaning, contextual meaning. So if you look into how these meanings were applied and how they were used by Indra, Brihaspati's speech, how Brihaspati's speech was utilized by Indra, in that utilization by Indra the meaning was lost and new meaning of structural semantic appeared, of syntactic semantic. Now, if I am telling you all this, I would be always in English or any other, especially modern language, when we say something, we always ask many times, do you know what I mean? Yeah? Because I may mean something else. What I do, I draw the picture for you with words. This is belonging to there, that belongs to here, and it comes back. Do you understand? Yes, I understood. It comes there, and comes there, and comes back. That's what we understood. Did we understand something deeper than that? Did we really understand?
Could you take an example of a Sanskrit sound and how it is becomes different words within the same, you know, similar semantic field?
Yes, we will come to this and we will see how this system of etymology built up the whole structure and the whole contextual meaning, because that is the subject of today's talk, that we could go beyond. But and what happened in the Western linguistics that etymology as such was considered to be only the parent of the word in historical perspective. Yes, yes, once it meant that, and then it changes meaning and it came to what? To this, what we have it now. Now, in order to use this word chair in my English speech, I have to remember that chair is to sit. Chair doesn't tell me that it is to sit. Table doesn't tell me that it is to write on. Nothing tells me about its own meaning. Nothing. Pistol is not saying to me that it is shooting. Nothing says about pen doesn't say that it is writing. I have to remember it. I have to apply to it some other memory of knowing what it means. Now if I come back to Sanskrit, every word, nearly every word, 99%, are transparent in their own etymological meaning. I don't need to know something else, because the word tells me that asanam is a sitting thing. Lekhani is a writing thing. I don't need to know that pen is to write. Lekhani already tells me that what it is to write. There is a transparent etymological presence throughout the language which makes it very vivid and very easily traceable in meaning. So this particular nature of Sanskrit was overlooked. It was not seen. They went very fast into their own discourses of phenomenology and so on and so forth, which was already there laid out by previous philosophers. And nobody actually truly studied this subject. But if they would look deeper, they would find semantically about which they even didn't think about. This semantic is well known to the poet. What is the difference, especially if we compare synonymia? What is the synonym? Yeah? If I tell you big ocean and huge ocean, I use this huge and big ocean. What is the difference between the two? Semantically, mentally, there is no difference. Yeah? They are the same. But there is a difference of some kind which we perceive, but we do not know how to express it. Because this difference comes from because they are derived from different roots, and they came to mean in this contextual layout similar meaning, but it is not the same. A huge ocean, a big ocean are two different meanings for the poet. If you can define for yourself these subtleties, then you will see that Brihaspati's speech is still alive. It is still influencing our speech. It is still wanting to express its own depth, its own vibration within the consciousness. Though it is, how to say, superimposed with a mental structure and with a mental developed language. So Madhyama is that what is language is about, it's this grammar, structure, syntax. It's the field which offers itself for the embodiment of the sound which comes, or for the embodiment of this pratibha, they call it. Pratibha is a flash of intuition. Now, pratibha flashes from above. It is being clothed, it is being put into particular form by language which offers itself. If pratibha comes and we offer English language, then it will be expressed in English language. If pratibha comes and we offer mathematical language, it will be expressed in mathematical formulas, in musical phrases, in dances, in anything else. So it depends on what Madhyama is, what kind of structure of relations, of these meaningful relations within the structure being proposed for Pratibha to embody itself. Do you see this? beautiful picture. But language does not end with our only verbal language. There are many other forms of language which are simultaneously present. My hands, my being here, sounding here in front of you, is also language.
According to Chomsky, that's the essence of language, it's creativity. And all of this structural change which is going on, this grammar, is creativity itself.
Chomsky broke through to that. He went a long way through his structure of language. And when he classified all possible relations, he discovered the deeper structure of syntax. And he saw that he first proposed, not first, because in medieval Europe that was already proposed, the universal grammar. And it's quite interesting because universal grammar says that basically all languages have the same similar structure, similar mental categories wherever you go. You can take most developed languages like English, or you go to aboriginal languages in Australia, you will find that they are self-sufficient and based on the same structure. There will be same categories, only they were expressed and would be expressed differently. What I wanted at 10 o'clock nearly to start with, it was only preamble.
What you just finished, you said all the languages have the same structure. London,
yeah.
Same
modalities, same categories. You cannot avoid category of subject and object. Just cannot. Even if you try very hard. Or you cannot avoid categories of number and gender. Yeah. Some languages have simplified these things. But even then, you would have always somewhere indication of some kind. They simplified it in the body of language, but not in the categories. And this difference between the embodied language and categories, mental categories, was known in Sanskrit grammar. I could show you examples of absolutely interesting kind, where the structure of language is not corresponding to the semantic which it represents, and the difference was figured out and fixed and understood. Any structure can express any semantic, basically. It depends how it does it.
Is Chomsky still going strong?
He's still going very strong. In fact, he's written some new books on linguistics.
Sir, I know he's going strong as a person, but is his theory still going?
Yeah, sure. It's one of the most... I think it's the only one which is now available seriously in the world.
Because I thought, like, for example, that Chinese hardly ever uses nouns and words as such distinguished from each other. I thought they were always having things like tabling and basically having words as verbs.
Yeah, if you come to Chinese, yes.
Yeah. And then they're so difficult to translate because there aren't, in normal Chinese, there's not that distinction between such and such.
Well, there is, yeah, sure, but they're not in that sense. It's an isolated type of language, it's a different type altogether, yes? We don't have such types.
Yeah, but this is the point, that it applies to a different type, otherwise this whole lot can be one family.
There was other Indra to create it. Indra cut it out differently, yes? So in a way... Yes, but it's fine, yes, why not? There can be other types, other cutouts, which is quite interesting to see. Yeah?
But even in Sanskrit, verbal roots can be changed into nouns. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. There are gradations. After, of course, we see separate sort of words, but that circulates, and it circulates.
It's a symbolic language as opposed to a transformational grammatical language. And the transformational grammar is based on Sanskrit, actually. So
it's not a verb. It's not a sound language.
Most of the languages that are living languages have this transformational grammatical
structure.
No, but you need only one strong exception to make the whole
So the hieroglyphic languages would have a different structure. But then if you relate those hieroglyphic languages to the process of knowledge, of knowing, you might find out that the structural aspect of the language is the same, and what's different is the symbolism,
but
the writing.
But it means nothing. Like you have types of consciousness where there is no proper subject-object distinction, so you might use that language.
Good field of research.
But still they understand each other, so they might say identify, you know, what is the subject and what is the object.
Not
for us, because we don't
not
understand the way.
You could live completely without making the distinction, isn't it?
We can live individually, but collectively we cannot. We need to communicate. I do not presume that this distinction is not there, because it seems to me highly impractical.
I don't think that's the final argument, but it's something practical. I think it might be possible to live and to be together and yet not make at all the distinction between objects and things.
I would love to see how it is possible altogether.
I
if you could even imagine it, if you could even...
I can very well imagine
it. It's a supramental little conditionalistic.
But the Chinese are not yet supramental.
No, I know, but we don't talk about languages, it's about the possibility. Definitely in the supramental world it will not be there, because it's keeping objects. So it's possible. I don't say that the Chinese have got it, please. But
I'm not sure it's possible. And if you can really show me that, I would be very grateful if really it is possible to avoid the sense and object of sense. Then you really kind of question the whole creation basis. Yeah.
But I think we have to do that, because if we want to go to this,
yes, wonderful.
Definitely we have to get out of this mind.
No, but in the supermind also there is a rajanya, the objectivation of the
consciousness. Yes, at the lower level.
Then you have a subject looking at its object, and
the
relation between the two.
Ah,
even within the supermind. So there is a distinction. It's not separate.
It's interesting for this scheme to just to see what Matthias is saying, but Shirubindo has a wonderful quotation about that, about this samjnana. Samjnana is a universal sense, and I will find for you now and read it, and then we go for tea. You know. Everything begins, as Shirubindo says, with vibration or movement, the original kshobha, the vibration, or disturbance. If there is no movement of conscious being, it can only know its own pure static existence. Now it has to move. It doesn't move, doesn't know. Without vibration or movement of being in consciousness, there can be no act of knowledge and therefore sense. If being does not move within consciousness, there is no sense, there is no knowledge. Without vibration or movement of being in force, now here we have power, force and consciousness, there can be no object of sense. There can be no object of sense. Now, the sense and object of sense is the movement of being within knowledge and force.
Sure.
The same being moves within its own consciousness, which is cittapas. That is what I've tried to show. It fits very well. Movement of conscious being is knowledge becoming sensible of itself as movement of force. One more time.
Yes.
Movement of conscious being as knowledge, becoming sensible of itself as movement of force. In other words, the knowledge separating itself from its own working, here trade comes in, to watch and to take it into itself again by feeling. This is the basis of universal samjnana.
Ah, but by that level you are down from the supramental in the
This is supramental. I think it is supramental.
No, but lower, is it the lower edge of the supramental?
It is
supramental in its old meaning,
okay.
Not in its new meaning. Definitely.
Supramental has three levels.
At the time that he speaks about these three levels, that is not the same word supramental that he uses at the end, that is an early tonality. It must be, because otherwise it doesn't fit.
But for us it is all right. I mean, for
that
me,
is above our mind.
More than yes, it is instructing my mind. It gives him a glimpse how this one being with his consciousness can present itself in this beautiful creation.
But you can think of another creation where you don't have that stupid subject object distinction.
I have a
and then words get smoother, then it becomes more harmony. As long as this is there, you have, it is always disjointed somewhere, it is always there with that distinction, there is the clash, there is a slight mismatch.
I think the subject-object distinction has been completely overcome in phenomenology. And I think that it's only the mind which is saying that there is a subject object distinction. In transformational grammar, there is no subject and object distinction. Here, everything on the semantic level is only an object in the sense that it is a subject. And it has already disappeared. The distinction has disappeared. So in transformational grammar, you have a noun phrase and a verb phrase. And the noun phrase transforms into another position in the relationship. But actually, all you have is motion and form in transformational grammar, and you don't have subject and object.
Okay.
And I think when Sri Aurobindo says something like that, it's difficult for us to even comprehend what he's actually saying, I think.
Because he
in fact is moving the subject around from force to consciousness to force to consciousness.
Yeah, what he did certainly.
And he is employing grammar to communicate something which is a totality of being. So yes, we need to overcome this subject and object way of thinking and this logocentric way of thinking, but when we say that we have a logocentric way of thinking that we overcome, it's just the mind.
There is a difficulty. But what you mean tries to describe, I think, is exactly the transition from a consciousness of oneness into the consciousness of split entity. That's what he describes, basically.
I think the whole
trick where we want to get is how to unfold that movement and go back to that understanding of oneness. And the question is, to what extent our language stands them in the way, because our language is entirely...
I have a question to you directly, Lame. I know you feel this deeply. Now, my question to you is, if you can try to communicate to us, what difference this makes for you in use of language?
I will come to that.
Yeah.
This is a very interesting thing. Why do we need all this exercise? What is the use of it? What does it change? Does it help?
Basically,
to change?
The application of the
Does it have any application to our life? It has, yes. It has some shift so dramatic that you start to value sound, you start to value the expression of everything. You start to become very sharp, you start to notice things which you would never notice before. These courses of, for example, Chomsky, of a deeper structure of language, because there is a depth in structure. And it is simple, it's also very traceable back to the mental forms. They are all formulated. It's not something which is not reachable or irrational, but it has depth. The same semantic depth is there. For example, when there was an attempt to describe what is meaning for computer artificial intelligence, that they faced a big difficulty because computer keeps asking. If you want to describe what is a pen, he says, okay, what is a pen? Pen is the thing, what is the thing? Thing is, thing is, pen is writing, what is writing? Who is writing, what is written, why writing? He wants to know everything in order to build up semantic. It seems that in our semantic field, when we use word pen, immediately the whole field, the whole universe is present at that moment. And supports this idea, this particular small drop of form, by its own evidence. We do not trace it back, we do not know it, we do not really perceive it. But computer shows us, spells it out for us that he cannot understand. Like what you mean until you describe the whole cosmos in all relations, and when you finish the description of that cosmos, it will still go on, so you will never reach it, you will never satisfy the computer's thirst to know.
But for you personally, you say the words, that you, the sound, you, because the sound means, has the meaning, no, the original vibration, so there you have the oneness. And so, is that what you try to listen for, or what is it?
I will tell you what it is. The university, when I was in the university, I did one interesting exercise without knowing that Sri Aurobindo already did the work of his, in his Origins of Aryan Speech, he made the whole layout. And then I understood that the sound, when I opened the dictionary, and I read dictionary very often, that the meaning is changing gradually as sound is changing. In a Sanskrit dictionary. If you see that, you will be surprised, because you take any other dictionary of any other language, you will see that the meaning is not corresponding with the change of sound. There is no gradual meaning change. You go page by page, if it is starting with movement, movement in this, movement in that, movement in this, vibration, expansion, and you go into another meaning as gradually as sound is gradually changing. Yes? Word by word by word by word. Am I make myself
clear? Yeah,
clear. And then I thought, wow, look at this. The meaning and sound correspond. It is as simple as that. So that means in the whole, throughout the whole system, it has to be supported. So what I did, I downloaded, I put all the roots into one, wrote them down from the dictionary and made the survey. I looked what they mean and how they sound, and I made the categories, and I saw this is like a table of chemistry, you know, chemistry elements. Everything is predictable. The change is gradual to the change of sound. Sound levels, sound fields are not only in themselves meaningful through derivation, but interact in a meaningful pattern among themselves. Whenever you meet sound E throughout, whatever root it may be, it will bring this particular varna, this particular color into it. You can trace it, it's visible. It's visible in the meaning. Now, contextual meaning is one thing, one has to learn that thing also, that meaning which is written in the dictionary is not really a meaning, it's how it is applied. Yeah? You take word Ari, I am using this example all the time, and it has two meanings, enemy and friend. Yeah? So what will you do? How will you solve the problem? Or you have root U, simple root, which means to unite and to divide. Another power. So if you look deeper, you will find that there is something else is implied. Other meaning is behind, which when applied in particular context can create these two meanings. So you have to deconstruct the contextual meaning to come back to the root, and where you, when you come to the root, you see it corresponds in the system of roots, and this is the most puzzling thing. So it is there.
Not puzzling, it is open. Because it makes things clear. It should have been like this.
Yes, but
puzzling is the modern languages that are all up there.
Well, you can't believe that it is there. And what I did in the university when we studied Vedas, I traced it back, I made for myself clear, and then I was definitely reading Vedas with my teacher, Vedic hymns, and I was not preparing myself for the reading. she was telling what we, I wanted to lead with this mind, seeing and recognizing meanings by that what I understood, and it works. And the teacher was asking me, how do you know this? I said, I don't know, but I know something about it, how it works. Because you can really, because when the context is defined within which you will have to apply these sound formations, you can figure out the meaning. Now, what does it give to me, this kind of exercise? You can figure out, you can think for yourself, would you like to have that? Then it recreates the ability, I think, which we lost, the ability to formulate, to, how to say, to express ourselves differently. Of course, we will go through stumbling in language all the time because of that interference of that words are not really reflecting, not really embodying that what I want to say. You can feel that they are not carrying the power of the meaning. They are structured. They are empty. They are void of meaning.
Conventional.
They are, yes. And you say them and you don't have anything. It doesn't touch you. It goes like, yeah, it's like slips away. So how to find that language which would have meaning which you can formulate within your consciousness and apply to particular context? How to find that origin and to recreate our ability in the mind to use that origin? That is the question. Maybe it's a question for the future development of man, that he has to recover this ability of creative consciousness, which can use these sounds and create new languages, which would be understood because we have this ability to understand.
It's what I thought. I mean, the more conscious we become on it, the more creative conscious is the use of language, and then on that is the creative power. And we have a model in the mantras, basically, that it's, how to say, there are formulas of creation, of creating states of consciousness, of creating reality. So, I mean, we are far away, we are still in one way formalizing our speaking, trying to understand, we're still working a lot with through the mind. Yeah? But once we come to the core of the creative power of the work, then we could use really our speaking for creation. For creating the new world, we feel it's there, we feel called to. All our words will actually help to create that state of consciousness.
Mm.
Perhaps that is why we have two different ways of speaking. Our informal speech and formal speech, for example, in a situation like this, when we speak, we are too much conscious of the structures and the formalities of speech and express everything through that, and that makes it less juicy compared to informal speech where we are unfolding freely and the structure is in between. And once the structure goes and the fluidity comes in, the word flows out freely, which carries the transformative power more and more.
It's very true. That's why it's so much better to be among friends and to speak openly and freely and than to become formal, because that structure is in itself becomes an art. Yes? If you see the best conferences you attend to the highest, the best speakers, they speak very wonderful and fluent and structured. But then what you gather out of it is the beauty of their creation. Creation of their structure, of the thought and mind. And then you come closer to the person and want to know what he really means. And there is nothing there. It is striking. I saw so many times that there is no more to offer than this beautiful creation in itself, which does not really tell you much more than you want to know. You want to be. You don't want to know some beautiful structure which you cannot use anymore and admire somebody for his ability of the mind to put it together. Because what, where it leads you, does it give you some new way of being, new poise of existence?
Letting me, according to just what you're saying, how did, because that was your study, you discovered this when you were studying, and since then, how did it deeply, what was the impact on your daily life, on your growth, on your way
daily
of hearing?
Daily life continued. The same way as before.
How did it shape you differently? I don't know.
Shape me. I became fat. Then I became thin again. Struggled a lot. I wanted to lose weight. Then I became crazy for ordinary things because this was too much to hold, and I fell deep down into the darkness. And I survived there. I came back. And all the other things happened to me.
This is not, I mean, maybe it's just a fantasy of mine, but I feel one of the primate purposes of word or language is to be in presence, or to invoke presence, or to invoke the meaning.
Heideggerian idea, yes? it's a kind of nostalgia for that ultimate significative, that's what Heidegger considered to be the end of philosophy. If we discover that word, which would bring the presence of that signified, then would be...
He said in silence is what is necessary for that.
Yeah. At the end, yes. So basically it ends with Om.
Reminds me of an argument I had with my students some years ago. They would say, when we speak with each other between us, we say like, wow, it's cool, man. And we understand each other so well. So, yes, but you cannot be sure that you understand the same thing. And say, no, we understand each other. We don't have to elucidate. So.
It's interesting formation.
A nice way to be, huh? Cool.
They actually say oh.
I mean, isn't it because we're in this, like we've surrendered ourselves, we said we're going to be intellectual this morning, and so you had to say om almost as a joke, and yet in the ancient tradition, that was the solution for what we're facing right now. We would say om, no? And go into meditation, or go into trance, or go into that higher state of consciousness, or at least worship it, at least be in awe of it. And perhaps we're being asked to do something similar. I mean, since the tradition hasn't brought us to anything beyond, it's not the last place, so where are we going to go now?
We're going to go to
tea now. That's an escape.
And then we're going to come back and explore mantra.
Actually, it was only a preamble, basically. I thought to go into the... Maybe it's enough of this preamble, because if you go into real quotations and studies, what Yaska said, what Patanjali spoke on language, what Bhartriyari says, what is theory of support or how it is being reviewed.
And all that will be available online?
Maybe I would put it better on, you can read it for yourself, but it won't be the same if I would say it. Yeah?
Sure.
And I wanted to show you also the etymological system, how it works, the root, how they are really embodying the meaning and the gradual change of meaning from sound to sound. But it will be maybe partly present. Partly I will take a little time, and then Rod will be presenting to you his bit on linguistics. So after tea I will take maybe at least half an hour. Is that okay? Or you want to start? A fresh start? Maybe we start fresh start.
We have to come back anyway.
Yeah, we know it's not possible to give everything.
Actually, I think what I want to present would be a good bridge to them.
Yes. Wonderful. So then we will stop for a while, and when we continue the studies later, Candy.
Is it the same paper what you had before in search of a new linguistics in light of Shrebunov?
Well, it changed quite a bit, and you're still in the same direction, right?
Learning with this recorder?
Yes, right.
Because I think it's of all these presentations that somewhere the essence could be, or at least what for you now was the essence of this presentation. If that could be put somewhere, or help, if you want to communicate it on the net, but else the things will go. And I think we have had a few beautiful moments and that came very much to the essence of the future language, etc. So to hold that and then maybe do later research on it, or form a study group wanting to go into the meaning of sound, see how we could go the roots, etc. So if that can be somewhere recorded, not only on that thing, but in a more...
It is all on paper, but the paper does not carry the meaning, as
no.
you know.
That's why. Right. So
you read it and you see, oh my God, so tiring.
Yeah, so to reformulate the essence, I think, and especially for all of us who are present, it will resonate again.
Yeah.
Possibly this formulation comes out what you said last time, you know, if people keep notes, because it's even always about experience. Mm-hmm. What you say, what's the essence, what are we experience essentially, you know, through such a presentation. And I think if that is shared of people, that he can do it for himself, but we can do it. A few people have can do it, and then it could be interesting to see on that session what happens.
Mm-hmm. So we have one definite direction of research, that is linguistics, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And there is much to be done.
Should we do what we decided actually last time, that next time mm-hmm. we take the first half an hour maybe to share what different people remember at the end of what we've talked?
Mm-hmm.
So those who are really interested mm-hmm. can make a short note of what they took and say, what good. Beautiful part of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then start to share that before we take the rest of the talk.
Yeah.
That will help to remember things and get a better continuity.
To review for half an hour. Just to touch.
To take the last part of the. Because the same people don't seem to show up.
I don't think so.
No, that is true. But if you do it at the end, then the whole story is coming, but it spoils that.
Yeah.
It's better to do it at the beginning.
I'm wondering, is each of our Saturdays going to be two presentations? Because that's really short. Like, it's one thing to say, Rod is going to bridge to the body of what Vladimir would like to share with us. But when?
No, I just put there the question. No? Well, maybe you can read it also. It's possible because once this seed is there, yeah, it can.
No, I'm wondering because I'm sorry, I haven't succeeded in getting onto the web, so I don't know what the schedule is.
All right.
It's booked with other things,
for
the next. So we're not coming back to you.
No, we are not
so
coming.
So we're going to have a bridge to something where we don't. So is it possible to have other, you know, like you would say, anyone who's really interested could meet me on X time? And
most welcome. But any time we can talk on the phone, meeting.
Oh,
I mean, anywhere. But there is in this private talks also there is something else happening. Yeah? There is no, how to say, this gathering of consciousness.
No, I'm thinking more of another supplementary thing. If a couple of people wanted to hear the rest, which I do, for instance, is there somebody else who'd like to hear the rest? Could we make a time?
In a way, yes. And time, I think, is a big problem. So I'm actually wondering whether the rest, your rest, so to say, whether it's so different from, say, Don's rest or my rest or whatever, whether not in the end, the
I think it's just feeding in one way, and that the process of consciousness happening.
Maybe it's enough.
And everybody's going to be on half a day, half a morning. Okay, but also how do you want to take it all? That, I think, is important now. Also, how you would like to take it forward now, and you could invite people for that, or make a proposal for that.
What we will do, we will put it on the mat, and we can discuss intensely there, yes? All the issues, if you like.
It's
not the same what you speak, yes.
On the mat,
we can read and meet.
You
can read first and then meet.
Let's see if it's there, then the field is there, and then say next week when we check in, people feel inspired and they think we want
to
keep it
there. Actually, can we continue this to people? If it doesn't work, if we find out it doesn't work, we find something
else. That's good. But as I recall, the purpose of these seminars was twofold. One, for us to get a preamble or the seed for what Vladimir's presentation with students.
Exactly, the real class which will come next
to
us.
Yes,
that's
it. And it has served its purpose because we know that we have discovered a format, first of all, which is very informal. He's not just lecturing, and we're like taking notes and just listening. We are also we've got input and the discussion proceeds at the same time as his presentation. So we know, and he pointed out that this format seems to be more productive than someone just lecturing. So we are in the process of discovering a format for the January session. And that's when that's when we will take his course and say, all right, now we want the full spiel on everything.
Okay.
Right now it's just these
little... Do you think Lord has one bite of it?
Yeah, a bite of it, a taste, a seed. We don't have that much time. Then it will be twice a week or whatever, you know, this sort of...
Okay.
Shall we have a tea?
Yeah.